I really crave, like, you know, there's this thing, like, people say, oh, I crave a pizza, I want a burger, I want whatever. I very rarely crave fast food like that.
Yeah.
Except for these. There's a place here called Maru Bhajias.
Yeah.
You know what bhajias are, right?
No, what's a bhajia?
They're like thinly sliced potatoes that are in a butter and fried. Right?
Oh, potato
and
chips.
Potato chips, basically. But not chips.
Wait, what are fritters?
I think fritters could be like anything fries. That's fried
like
dough.
Yeah, like they're like coated in something.
Right? They have a butter.
Yeah, so this is also coated in.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and it's not like super thin, like Pringle type. It's slightly thick. And it's still kind of soggy. It's not like a chip. It's not like a potato chip. Anyway, that's what they're called. And I love them very much. I've even asked to work here.
Oh, yeah?
Yes,
and
I named like, my... They've been here forever. Yes.
You just want to work here so you can steal their recipe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll work for free.
I even named my dog Maru.
Oh.
My first dog.
It's a love story.
So, like, maybe we can...
should we get some of those? Sorry?
Can we eat Maru Bhajias here?
Yeah, they've changed the rules.
So let's go sit inside.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So, chili, the tamarind. Trick to eating this is you'll have to make a little hole.
Oh, yeah.
And then put this in and then put a little bit of each.
It's going to be like my ugali.
And then just pop it all in your mouth.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a little of one sauce.
Yeah.
Whichever.
No.
All of them.
The mint. The tamarind and this is
all right, cool.
Good luck.
And then
a little bit of each.
Yeah. Boom.
And then just cup it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah?
That's so good.
Yeah.
It is a new year. Hey, 2021, good vibes only around here, so let's pick up where we left off in the last Nairobi episode, pre-COVID, with the 44th tribe of Kenya, the Kenyans of Indian descent. For all of my talk in these episodes of factionalism in Nairobi, you only need to come here, to the Diamond Plaza food court, to see how delicious the mix can actually be. Here lies a shrine, a living, boiling, sputtering deep fat fryer of a shrine to one of Nairobi's favorite snacks, Maru Bhajia, which, as I now know, is what would happen if the Lord Jesus Christ were to come back to Earth in order to save us all and also to improve upon the flavorless corporate wafers we know as potato chips. Maru Bhajia may have arrived with the 44th tribe, but it belongs to Nairobi now, and joining it in the Kenyan cupboard are dishes from China, West Africa, Portugal, Arabia, the British Midlands, and more. Now, I get the sense, even when talking with Kenyans, that the national cuisine here is a little bit unknown, a little unloved. But as much as anything, that might be a reflection of the power of Kenya, its geographic legacy as the bridge between the Great Lakes, the Bantu expansion lands, and everything and every bite off the African coastline. We Americans love our exceptionalism. Even us progressives, who like to think that the U.S. at its best is the world's preeminent melting pot. That's not wrong necessarily, but the comfort that I feel here in Nairobi, awash in deep strains of dozens of cultures, is at least a sign that Kenyans also know a thing or two about melting and mixing. I knew that I wanted to talk these things out with food obsessive Joshua Obaga, who had first brought me and a friend of his to Diamond Plaza. I did not know until a gardener from the property next to my hotel showed up with a thick bundle of fresh, bitter-smelling greens that Joshua and I would talk about these things while trying to chew khat, the mild narcotic stimulant that is illegal in the U.S., just barely tolerated in Kenya, and often paired here with sweet sodas. Warning, this episode documents two adult men drinking Sprite and slowly dribbling on themselves. Proceed with caution. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. Let's talk about what you and I are going to imbibe here. Let's get that. Let's get that going. What is this?
Well, I am not a... consumer of Mira. It's called Mira.
Mira.
Yeah, M-I-R-I-A-A. But it's one of our legal stimulants.
Okay.
It's kind of like a more affordable version of coffee, like for certain populations.
Right.
Yeah.
Because getting a good drip coffee is still going to be...
Exactly.
Java House notwithstanding, it's still going to be too expensive for a lot of people.
Yeah, we don't... Our coffee culture is not as deep as, let's say, the U.S. or Ethiopia or Saudi Arabia or whatever.
But Kenya exports a lot of beans.
We are more about the capitalist.
Yeah, right.
You know,
more about selling than sipping. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you're not going to try this then?
I will.
You will. Okay.
The last time I had some, though, I was in high school.
In high school?
Yeah. This was like 2001.
So I'm trying to place it. I mean, we also know this in the States as Kat, right? Which is a name throughout, you know, Yemen and Somalia and all the places where it's like deeply popular.
Yeah.
But it's like trying to place it on the, kind of like chewing tobacco, maybe in the States.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like that thing that people experiment with in high school, and then some people just do it as a lifelong thing, and it gives you this mild head buzz or something. And I've had kat before, but more in like, I think, in an Arab context. Mm. So when, you know, I was talking with somebody about the ways that they, you know, chew it here, and it was kind of like, oh, kat and Sprite, like, did not expect that. And there is also, as you were saying, there's a strain of chewing kat with bubble gum, so that you end up with like this golf ball, and that sounds like a lot of work to
actually,
me.
Actually, it's called a taxi.
A taxi?
Yeah, so it gets to a point where you chew so much, and it's a specific kind of gum called Big G, which is like a OG, like Kenyan gum.
The OG Kenyan gum, all right.
And then you eat like a bunch of them, and you keep adding more gum, and it becomes this humongous like ball of nothing. Like, what do you call it? Like spit and cat and gum. It's crazy.
God, you are really working my appetite. That sounds amazing. I would love to watch that.
All right.
No, and I had heard, I guess, that is the preferred way in Uganda. Mm. I'm psyched we're doing Sprite. I don't think I need a taxi.
Yeah.
A big old ball of spit and gum and cat leaves. All right. So walk me through this. Tell me how this goes.
I feel like you probably have more experience in this than I do.
All right.
What I remember is, and what I've observed, is, you know, they take the leaves out and they chew it on the side.
And they chew it on the side?
Yeah, side of your, like inside your cheek.
And I wonder what the Sprite is supposed to do, you know, the Sprite in this equation.
How I think it? Maybe it's about flavor. So I think maybe it's bitter, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the Sprite, the acidity and the sweetness of the Sprite kind of offsets that bitterness.
This is beautiful. I need, I'm gonna take a rare podcast pause to do an Instagram
yes, picture. Of course.
Because it's, I mean, they are gorgeous. This is also fresh, local Karen kat.
Where did you get this from?
The gardener next door grows it.
That's insane.
It is insane. So this is heirloom heritage, you know, organic. I don't know if it's organic, but it is just like very fresh.
Yeah.
Fresh kat. Because usually it's dried and you know, this'll last a while. This is also, I would say, about a kilo, maybe not a kilo. But it is a huge amount of kat.
It is quite a lot.
Yeah. I didn't specify how much to bring, so he brought enough for an entire village. So I'm gonna send you home with a lot of kat.
Okay.
And excellent. You can distribute it amongst your friends and see where you go. All right. Well, I'm extending the bushel to you.
Oh, wait, thank you. And so I would assume you take a few and then you like tear some seeds off, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, sorry, some leaves.
I'm getting a little static in the mic. I wonder if it's just all of the cation or whatever the stimulant in the kat is. It's like it's causing the wires to jump, become alive.
Maybe it's my aura.
It is your aura. I know. Well, I was saying that, you know, one solution to Nairobi traffic is going to be for me to eat all of this kat and just run alongside the Boda Boda guys.
How long have you been here?
I've been here 3 days.
Have you been here before?
Never been.
You said Boda Boda very naturally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like somebody who's been here.
I did have a for me, a very memorable Boda Boda ride across town. which was not safe boda. It was whatever the opposite of safe boda was. So I feel like I really I put in my time, my mileage. Yeah. Okay, so we're snipping off some leaves here, getting ready for that big chew.
I'm gonna wait for you.
A little handful.
We can just chew. We can cheers before.
Let's cheers. Right, that's the right thing. You cheers and then chew. Yeah. Pour a little bit of Sprite in this. Nice glass bottles. Mm-hmm. I would get that sound of that clinking.
There you go.
Cheers. Joshua, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
All right. Super fresh. Very bitter.
That is very fresh. Mm. That's weird.
The Sprite absolutely helps.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Oh, I'm digging that. Yeah. It's a little like... Yeah, I can kind of feel my mouth going numb.
Yeah. Me too.
And it's hard not to swallow it. How do you like...
I think that's why you put it in your cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, oh, God. It's doing that thing.
Oh, yeah? What is that thing?
It's okay. So I'm either going to have to swallow it or like spit it into a thingy.
Well, this is what you realize too about like beetle culture in like Myanmar, you know, the guys, it's another kind of chewable stimulant. And it takes so much skill to do it without just making an absolute mess of yourself. I'm getting the sense with this too, is like, right. I'm not talented enough to just like tuck it away and hang on to it. Like I'm just kind of eating the leaves, which I'm pretty sure is a party foul. Wow.
That was interesting.
I mean, you're a food guy. How would you describe the flavor of that?
Bitter.
Yeah.
Like fresh grass. That's what it tastes like.
Right.
Or, yeah, like this, it tastes like the smell of freshly cut grass.
Yeah, yeah. All right. That is spot on.
Yeah.
But you are the, you know, where I am the cow in this scenario, grazing in the meadow.
Yeah.
And I do, you know, I think in my long quest around the world to find different ways of making weird mouth noises into the microphones, I think we've hit a new level here. We're like... Just a big chew.
You do like mukbang.
Oh my God, this is like the audio version of watching someone eat. The problem with audio, I mean, granted, I don't really get the appeal of mukbang in the Korean context, but yeah, chewing in audio is it's a real experience for you, the listener. You are welcome.
My reception of listening to chewing sounds changes based on my mood. Sometimes it's like...
Wait, you have a mood where you're into it?
Yeah, sometimes I'm like, yeah, that's kind of very satisfying, like to listen and look at. But sometimes it's like, this sounds like I'm on like a porn set. Like, microphone is too close. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a lot of moisture, man. This is like, that lip smacking is hip smacking.
It's too much.
Yeah.
So I swallowed.
Yeah, me too. I'm sure they're like, you know... There's a whole community of Boda Boda drivers who would look down very, very haughtily at us for our cat powers. But, well, anyway, you have now, most of a kilo of cat to distribute. I mean, I'm sure you can find somebody who will enjoy that.
I'll try and figure out. I could probably like make it into an ice cream or something.
Oh, yeah?
That'd be interesting.
So I was out, speaking of ice creams, I was out... doing what I like to do, which was we were out drinking and kind of going around different places in Nairobi last night, and a Scotch bonnet pepper jam came up.
Yep.
Your jam is like being discussed in nightclubs and bars around the city.
Yeah.
All right, so let's start there. What are you making and why?
I like to cook everything. Like I don't have a... Usually, I don't even like to use the word chef. Like, I'm not formally trained. I haven't staged yet, like, anywhere. But I like to explore as much as I can. And I do like fine dining because it's all about exploration and finding yourself within a meal or within the identity of a restaurant. And so I try to explore as much as I can using different techniques of preparing food, looking at something and saying, okay, what are the 12 different things I could do with this one ingredient that would bring out the best in it? And with Scotch bonnets, I do work with chili a lot because I never liked chili growing up. And so I've always tried to find something positive within a food that I don't typically like. I don't like pineapples. I don't like watermelon. I don't like chili.
And so now you're just the pineapple, I'm just like, watermelon, I
wanna,
chili man.
I want to try and figure out how to make watermelon taste, you know, much better than it does. or present it in a way that I would eat it.
Like, you are not God. Watermelon, isn't it? No, you're gonna find watermelon to the next level of evolution.
I found a way to, like, to make it a bit better. You can actually remove the water and replace it with something. So
it's just a melon.
It is a melon, but then it's kind of, the texture is a bit different and the flavor is a bit different. So if you leave it in lemon juice for 24 hours, it kind of cures it. So it becomes a little bit kind of like a rare steak. Wow. Rather than this, like, squishy, spongy thing. And it's a bit more acidic, and with the sweetness, it goes really well. I think the thing I didn't like about it was the combination of the super wateriness and the, like, ultra squishy. I didn't like that combination. But I figured out how to, like, I hacked it.
How to hack it. I love that. Yeah. Melon hacks. So the same with Scotch bonnet. And you didn't like chili growing up, but it's also true that like, spice is not a big feature of Nairobi food, at least, right?
Well, what do you mean by Nairobi food?
I don't know. This is what I heard. It's like, and you know, it's like an axiom throughout the world, right? The mountain foods tend to be a little heartier and less, like, spice filled. So, I mean, that strikes me as an axiom that maybe I'm just totally, I'm definitely talking out of my ass, but you know, that you got, like, in the mountains, like we are here at 5,000 feet above sea level in Nairobi, you know, you'd have, like, heartier, maybe less spicy foods. And then down by the coast, you have more heat to it. But in here, I mean, in the Kenyan perspective, that's specifically that you have, like, more Indian influence on the coast and things like that. So I don't know, but you tell me, like, what is Nairobi food?
I mean, when you talk about the coast, first of all, that was where the port is. And so that's where all the Portuguese and the Arabs and the Indians came through. And so you find a lot of influence from those parts of the world. And spice, of course, is a huge part of those three cultures, right? But in Nairobi is the hub of the whole country. It's a capital city. It is socially, not just economically. And what that means is that you have, you know, five generations of Indian families in Nairobi. You have white families in Nairobi. You have, of course, now people from different parts of the country coming to Nairobi. So you have so many different kinds of food here. Spice, when it comes to indigenous eating, spice is not really a thing. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, the Asian Kenyans are not Kenyans, or like Asian Indian food is not Kenyan food. So Indian food has always been available here.
Yeah.
And so spicy food has always been available.
Got it.
So things like turmeric and cardamom and stuff are things that we grew up eating and drinking, because it's also we put it in our tea as well.
Yeah. I mean, well, that dawa is nuts. Like, that's a lot of flavor in a tea experience. Yeah.
But then there is the conception of, like, Kenyan food is bland and it's very, like, it's just salt. Like, there's no...
But that means writing Indians out of the cuisine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So you got Scotch bonnets. Mm-hmm. You're gonna make a jam.
So I have made a jam before. I've made a Scotch bonnet jam before, which was fantastic, first of all. I actually was trying to make, like, a chili sauce, like a Scotch bonnet ketchup thing. And so I added vinegar and added sugar, but I added too much sugar. after it caramelized, and I was like, oh, this kind of, this is interesting. This kind of works. So I added more.
The Thomas Edison of Scotch bonnet, exactly. Tomfoolery. All right.
Yeah. So I, and then it was a bit thin, so I added some xanthan gum. So it became like a pasty, like jam type thing, which now we use to put on our toast and stuff. Like it's, it was a mistake, but it worked really well.
Behold.
Yeah.
And thus was born.
Yeah.
Jam. So, all right. So you're going to make cod ice cream now. We got all this fresh cod. How do you do that? What's the plan?
I'd have to cook it first and see if it cooks. So I can't just like blend it because it would just be ultra bitter.
Yeah, that's true.
Unless I make a bitter ice cream. If you make a bitter ice cream, then you can put some like, you can shave some lemon on it. Maybe put like a syrup, like a lemon syrup.
Oh no, bitter ice cream sounds like a cruel prank on children or something. Ice cream's supposed to be smooth.
I don't know. Like, I like the idea of playing around with, like, looking at something and expecting something.
Yeah.
And eating it and experiencing something else completely.
Yeah. But then you would have kind of like the Breaking Bad problem, which is, you know, how do you cook drugs? I mean, there's like, there are active narcotic or stimulant, elements in this. And like, if you blend it, does that break it down? Like,
it's a good question. Yeah. I'd have to now do research on like the, molecular level.
Yeah.
Like what happens?
On the cathine. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure Noma has had a lot of cot in their fermentation labs or something, but.
I mean, like marijuana, CBD oil is a thing.
Yeah.
So maybe if you can extract the active agents, the active element in the cat, and then use that. The same way that, what's his name? Number two chef in the world. Spanish guy. Roca.
Oh, Joan.
Joan Roca.
Yeah. Okay.
I watched his like episode of Chef's Table.
Okay.
And he was talking about his relationship with his dad and how his dad used to smoke cigars. And then he figured out how to, there was a time he was churning ice cream and he blew cigar smoke into it and it churned the cigar smoke in the ice cream. And so when you eat it, it is like smoky. It has that cigar flavor. And that really sparked my imagination when it came to the idea of using stuff that is very close to home. Uh-huh. That you wouldn't typically think about, like cigar flavored ice cream. Like what the hell is
like
that?
Like ashtray ice cream.
Yeah. There's a girl who told me, because I smoked cigarettes for a long time.
Yeah.
And
I've never smoked a cigarette in my life.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Cigarettes are great, kids. You'll love them.
Oh my God.
You're going to love them so hard. You're going to find it very difficult to quit them. I'm just laying out your life path here,
and,
children.
She used to tell me, like, the first time I met her, I was smoking a cigarette. It was in a club. And she looked at me and she was like, you're so handsome. And you're so, like, everyone talks about you. And you seem like a really smart guy. Why do you smoke cigarettes? It's like, because they're great. I mean,
I used to hate that girl. You know, the like the pedant at the nightclub.
Oh
yeah, okay.
And then she told me, you know, kissing a man who smokes is like licking an ashtray.
Yeah.
And that image has never, that was like 15 years ago. Like that has never left my
It's
head.
Too bad that that fucking Chef's Table episode wasn't there. You'd be like, watch this. This is a world famous, you know, number one restaurant in the world flavor that you're getting, baby.
Exactly.
Joanne has made this just for you, my ashtray mouth. What that fails to, acknowledge is that smoking makes you look cool, which makes you get the girls.
Yes.
So I reject the premise.
She probably wouldn't have talked to me if she didn't smoke.
That's right. She just wanted to have something to talk to you about. Man, I'd make the worst PSAs, you know.
Yeah,
my public service announcement game is real weak, real thin. All right.
My mom's going to listen to this.
Hey, Mom. Hi, Mom.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off My Rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin Marshall credit card bill.
All right, you're a watcher of Chef's Table. You see their, you know, their kind of general global gastronomic game. Yeah. How does the Kenyan food and cuisine scene compare to that?
That's an interesting question. So, like, I'm very much in the middle of it because I love what they do, but there's also an element of, I mean, there's separation in food. There's a class separation. There's, you know, agricultural, geographical separations. And so when it comes to fine dining, if you look at Europe and the US, there is a very rich history in the idea of having, even the word fine or haute cuisine, like, means like high end, right? And so the social hierarchy determined what people ate. Here, we of course were colonized. I'm still doing research on pre-colonial, like, agricultural or cultural anthropology, basically, but with food before.
The colonization kind of blacked out the rest of the history of the place.
Exactly. They didn't even block it out. They just brought a new story. Think about ugali. Ugali is here because of colonialism. Ugali is it's Kenyan food, but it's really not. Like,
where did it come from?
So the Portuguese came with it, right? Yeah. And then the English figured out that they could pay workers with maize. So they mainstreamed the idea of maize. So ugali existed as a dough-like porridge, right? Mm. It's a thing that you see all over Africa. But before the maize flour came, we used to use millet and sorghum.
Right, brown ugali.
Yeah, brown ugali, which I really like, right? And the thing is, now they figured out that maize was much cheaper to grow and was easier to manage than sorghum. And then they used to use maize flour as payment for their slaves and their workers.
Okay.
And so it became something that everybody used to start eating because it's just like, this is basically what we're eating because it's our payment, our sustenance.
And for context, ugali as it is now, and I'm basing this off, I went with the journalist Barbara Wanjala to a Luo restaurant.
Yeah.
Kosewe in the central business district.
Yeah.
And she's from a Luo family, I guess. And so she took me there. And there was, so this ugali is like, it's maize, the white one, and then there's the millet version, which is brown. But it's basically this kind of hard dough, and what's a good textural description? It's kind of like a slightly firmer version of like a cookie dough in terms of the texture.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah,
and you basically make a little bowl or eating utensil out of it, and you know, we had like these great fish and goat intestines, and you make this little thing, which I did so laughably bad, just like creating these like the worst kindergarten sculptures, you know, clay Play-Doh problems possible. But she's, you know, she was kind of training me up, and you use it basically as both a base for grabbing the food and then something to accompany. And it's like incredibly filling. Mm-hmm. It's like one of those shakes that they have in Peru, which are just like so dense that like a worker has one in the morning and then does like hard labor all day.
Yeah,
it's a really amazing food stuff, and it's like the quintessential Kenyan thing food.
Yeah,
which, as you're pointing out,
is not really
Kenyan. Not really. Yeah.
But then that's the thing I love about this country, is that it's not, at least Nairobi, because it's not one thing. It's so many things that are part of our culture that you'd be surprised are not, you know, things like skuma wiki. Have you eaten skuma wiki?
No.
It's basically collard greens.
Okay.
So ugali and skuma are like, that is the number one thing people think about with Kenyan food.
Okay.
Ugali, skuma wiki, and some meat, like some
goji. Actually, meat. I think they had some on the table there.
Yeah, the green.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was, right, it was very much like a collard, and it was good.
Yeah.
I mean, deeply
so,
good.
Like, that's also like not Kenyan, but it's ultra Kenyan at the same time, and I love that. So when I was a kid growing up, like, my mom used to travel a lot for work, and my dad they were both teachers, and then my mom left teaching to like work in an NGO, and then she got to travel around the world, and everywhere she went, she used to learn something new and come back home and cook.
Oh, cool.
And so like...
Man, I should do that. I do not do that for my
really
kids.
Should.
I know. What's wrong with me?
I wish you came over. I would have cooked for you. Anyway, so I realized now, like when I started taking cooking more seriously, because I have a background in design. So like my thing is, I used to be an art director in an advertising company. And
you were at Ogilvy.
I was at Ogilvy.
Yeah.
How do you know this?
Listen, your name rings out in this city. right. So you had a big job in kind of marketing and advertising and design.
Yeah.
And that was not right for you.
I wouldn't say it wasn't right because I still love design. Design is a big part of who I am, and the thinking behind it is very similar to the thinking in cooking, where you have a brief. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And you have...
the client brief is always the same.
It's always the same.
I'm feeling hungry. What can we do about this?
Yeah,
let's solve this problem.
And then you think about the process. Rather, you think about what you want in the end. What is the point? You know, what's your KPI? And
this is good. This is a very unusual conversation about cooking. But yes,
and,
client briefs and KPIs.
And like... And I realized it's the same thing. When I left advertising, it's because I got sick. I had a problem. I had a blood clot in my brain, which is not fun.
Wow.
And so there was a point
Jesus,
where...
Jesus, I'm sorry.
I'm fine now. This was many years ago.
Yeah.
And so like there's a point where I got into the office and I sat down and I said, I could literally die here. Like, I don't want to die. What do I want to do? I have no idea what I want to do, but I don't think I should be here.
Yeah.
Not because the job was bad or the environment was great. I was still very close with my ex-boss. And
I mean, not to make light of having a blood clot, but it does feel like that's a conversation that more people should have with themselves on a daily basis. Like, do I want to die at this desk?
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, nothing is guaranteed us except that we are going to die.
Yeah.
Could be at this desk.
Absolutely.
You never know.
Yeah. And I used to work so hard. I used to be in 7:30 in the morning, leave at like at least 11 p.m. Because I came in before I was an AD, I was freelancing for so long. And so I was very used to doing everything myself.
Mm.
I wasn't used to running a team or telling people what to do. It's just like, you're adults, just like do the thing you're supposed to do. Come on. I'm very hands-off management. And so I ended up doing a lot of stuff by myself, and I didn't sleep much, of course, advertising. And so when I left, I was just like, okay, I just need to rest. Like, basically need to just prioritize resting. And I realized that after some time, I realized that even if I was sick, I was still cooking every day.
Hmm.
And then I thought about it, and I was like, I've been cooking since I was like 5 years old. Why am I not taking this more seriously?
Yeah.
You know? And so I started exploring. This was 2015. That's when I started like really trying to look into what is it, what really makes, what is cooking about, what is food about. And at this point, the reason why I don't call myself a chef, aside from the fact that I haven't been trained, is because I'm more interested in the process and the understanding of people, understanding of ingredients, understanding of the science behind things, understanding of aesthetics.
Yeah.
So like, I am more of an explorer of things.
That's great. No, there's like a whole, you're part of a whole movement, I guess. We have a lot in the States and Europe, and I guess I'm some part of this, of like the food intellectual industrial complex, you know, which is like, I don't really cook, but I'd like to think about food and talk about it. And you know, somehow, you know, QED, there's a living to be made out there somehow doing that. But how do you make that function in a Kenyan context?
So because I do have a decent reputation in design, I have used my networks to still maintain design work.
Mm-hmm.
But I am very specific about it now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do design work related to food specifically.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So labels for products that I like. So like products that are very mindful and sustainable environmentally.
Yeah.
Products that are interesting and new, but then locally made. Products of people who pay their workers really well, or source their stuff from people who, like, from different tribes around here. So like, if I understand the vision of a company and they want my services, I like do design for them. And it's not just product labels, branding, it's logos, it's websites, it's, you know, photography, whatever. And that's what I do for a living. So when it comes to the food itself, what I'm doing, I'm not charging anyone for anything yet. And I haven't done anything that I think I would sell yet.
Yeah.
But I am kind of writing like a little book.
Okay.
That should be out soon.
What's it about?
It's just stories. It's just stories about random different things, like everything that I'm interested in. I mean, I really like flowers for some reason. So like I'm everywhere I've traveled in Kenya, I've always like looked around to see, do I know this flower or not? Huh. And then I use a plant identification app and I'm like, okay, is this edible? Like, that's the first thing that I think, like, is this an edible plant?
That's fish love, man. You love it, but just because you want to eat it, huh?
Hey.
Yeah.
All yeah, right. I know about fish love. Rabbi.
Yeah. breaking out internet memes now. That's how you love flowers.
Yeah. No, I do love flowers because I'm like, it's a thing that was not the idea of, you know, fine dining. The one of the most pretentious things that people say
about
fine dining is like, oh, just put this like small portion of something and then put like a flower in it.
Yeah, with the tweezers.
Yeah, with the tweezers, yeah. Right? Which I do have. We never grew up eating flowers and things. Flowers are to look at and to smell and like, that's it. And for like bees to like pollinate. But as I grew, I saw and observed like the world and like what people do in cooking in Asia, the US, in Europe. It was like, put some nostalgia leaves on it and put some like
right
like pansy blossoms on it, and I was like, oh, this is interesting, why would you do that? It's a flower, like what the hell.
Yeah.
And the more I realized that there is so much stuff that I don't know, flowers made me realize I don't know anything, because there's so much information that is so common to other places that is not common to me. So it made me actually want to bridge gaps between myself and every other.
And all the knowledge that you could be getting.
And so I just started reading and reading and reading and like watching stuff. And Anthony Bourdain, huge, huge, huge part of why I'm not working in a restaurant, actually.
Yeah.
Because
you were like, I could skip that step.
Yeah.
And go straight like to why? The explorer and, you know, writer phase of things.
I read his book. Actually, it's April who got me his book.
Oh, yeah.
Kitchen Confidential.
April Zhu, right?
Yeah.
Who is a local journalist here who's great and had written for Roads and Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And I think is part of the Joshua Obaga fan club that was following me around last night. Good for her. So yeah, she got you. I did reread it not that long ago. It's a fucking great book.
I was so sad not to meet him.
Like, yeah.
I loved him so much. And he was, when I found out that he was in Kenya and someone told me, I saw a photo of a bunch of my friends met him when he was here. They were in the episode.
Yeah, like Kenya. Kevin Wachito.
Yeah, and, Kevin and Mal and Heather Rao. Like, these are people I've known for a long time.
Yeah.
And they're like, I was like, how do you were meeting like one of my idols and you did not, I just saw a random photo on Instagram. Like, this is my idol.
Yeah.
And so like what I did for 3 days was I put that book in a little duffel bag and I walked around. I went around Nairobi. I was just like, I'm not doing any work. I'm not like meeting anyone. I'm just going to look for Anthony Bourdain.
Look to see where the entourage is. Yeah. Well, I have to say, as amazing a person as he was to know and work with, I think the mileage can vary on meeting him while he's shooting, because it's like he's very in the zone.
Yeah,
I think his instinct is always to like be generous and giving and so on. But sometimes he's just like, I've seen him in shoots where he's like 1,000 miles away, you know. So, but I've never had anybody who's like thought it was unpleasant. But he communicated himself so well that people brought so much energy to him, you know.
Yeah,
which could be really, really incredible. But it's hard for him to give it back.
Yeah.
Whatever. No, it sucks. You missed out.
Yeah. Oh my god. It's okay now. I have a bunch of his books. And
yeah.
I'm fine, and I got to meet you. So like, oh, I feel go. Like
that's right. By the transitive like property. I mean, that is one of the things that also that makes writing great. I mean, you know, we all do this as a legacy project on some level. It's just like that something may survive our bodies, you know, when we die at our desks. And writing can, you know, I think for Tony especially, I'm really, really getting that sense of how true that is. Like, you know, his voice, he was very good at putting his voice on the page, and his voice comes out loud and true, and it's a fucking hologram, you know? It's a hologram reading that book, or really any of the stuff he's written. Even even, you know, dumb emails that he's written, you know, to me, it's like, I just, it just pops. And we'll like text each other, like just random, you know, this last year he wrote me this thing, and just to have a few sentences that, that, they just feel like him. So, you know, so when, while you're smoking, kids, you should also be writing, because writing is a way that you are going to survive your own death. And live forever.
That is insane, because that is the motivation behind a lot of what I do, is that I'm like somewhat nihilistic about a lot of things. It's like millennial flu, I guess. Like everybody is wants to die, but like, nobody really wants to die.
Everybody kind of wants to die, but doesn't really.
So for me, like, legacy is important. That's my dad. His dad, well, I come from a line of like musicians and farmers. So
musicians and farmers.
Yeah, like, oh, that's my a good dad, combination. My grandfather was a farmer professionally, but he was amazing, amazing musician. And his, all of his kids became really good at music. And now my dad got to a point where he got his PhD in music.
Oh, shit.
And he was a music teacher for a long time in a really good school. And I grew up, you know, playing classical music and like listening to jazz and listening to Kenyan music and listening to a bunch of different things. And so that kind of introduced my mind to the idea of multiculturalism, multidimensionalism, different perspectives and how people express themselves in different ways. And that's something I applied in design, something I apply in food. It's very easy for me to meet people from different parts of the world, because I'm like, oh, you're from Burma. I know you guys eat this and this. And they're like, what the hell? Who are you? And like, I love getting different perspectives from people, but also, it's also a journey of like, who am I? Because I feel like I'm a third culture kid, but who hasn't lived in a different country?
Well, that is one of the joys of Nairobi, right? Like, you can be a third culture kid because there's so much is whizzing around in the atmosphere, you know? All right, let's take a, I'm going to take a, an audio break to, sponsored by Sprite.
Oh, that's very satisfying.
Isn't that satisfying?
Yeah.
Doesn't that feel good? I should also, like one of those annoying guys at the party, I'm going to do a check-in on my, my buzz.
Go for it.
Like, I'm feeling, I don't know if I'm imagining it, but I'm feeling this cot has like got me a little jumpy, right?
I feel, I don't know what the word is. I feel okay, but slightly, like my heart isn't racing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Not yet. Yeah.
But no. I do feel lightheaded, slightly lightheaded. Mm-hmm. Like that's all I feel.
Yeah. I'm not like freaking out or anything, but I feel like, I think I'm feeling this thing. But, you know, I just, anybody listening to this podcast should be super glad that I never get high on this podcast, because I would just be talking about how high am I? Am I actually high? What am I feeling? What am I seeing? You know, it's a, it's an obnoxious trait that I have. It's like anytime I get somewhere on the stimulant to narcotic thing, I have to really like, really, you know, feel where I'm at. You know?
So, I mean, that's important.
I guess so. Although, I, you know, for the people who, again, like, chewing tobacco, I guess if you do this daily, you're not like, oh, I feel, you know, it's like a maintenance high almost. Exactly. So they're probably not on the side of the road chewing, just thinking, is my heart going a little faster? Yeah, maybe it is. All right. So you are kind of building, building a life for yourself in, in this very kind of clever way, which is you have a purpose in the market, you know, through your design work, but then you're also kind of experimenting and becoming Nairobi's leading purveyor of cot ice cream. I'm already naming you. What do you, what would you like to see from the Kenyan, just how Kenyans feel about food, or like, I don't know, is there something, is there some improvement in the way that they can approach what they, what they're doing, or is there something that the, I don't know, let's start there.
I really don't like judging people's decision-making process. Because I also recognize that I'm a little bit of a snob. I'm not
a self-awareness that is sorely lacking in me and so many others. Right.
Like slightly, because I love street food. Like that's, I would eat street food before, like I get like a pizza and a burger, right? I'd rather make a pizza and burger at home.
Mm-hmm.
It's more interesting and you have more control.
Yeah.
But the thing that I'm concerned about a lot is the influx of franchise fast food, KFC, Burger King.
Yeah.
I heard Starbucks is coming and McDonald's. And I'm like, okay, I mean, it's fine. I, as a person who has been in branding for a long time, I understand the Kenyans are all about hype. We love new things. We love the new shiny toy. But based on what the growth of this industry has done to specifically the US, I'm really afraid. Like, I'm so scared.
Yeah, you look across the ocean and you're like, oh no, please.
Like, no, I don't want that to happen. I want people to be able to enjoy fries and burgers and shit, but like, can we moderate?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I mean, it's not snobbish to, you know, absolve you here. It's not snobbish to just point out that there's a finite amount of funding and resources and attention that can go into what people are eating.
Yeah.
And particularly where, you know, KFC, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it occupies a kind of like a middle class, you know, it's more expensive. It's kind of aspirational.
It is.
And so it's for people who actually have resources that they could eat, you know, like really great, you know, maybe more refined or better marketed or branded versions of Kenyan foods, whether it's Indian Kenyan or African Kenyan. I mean, like whatever the food culture is, it could be in that space, but it's kind of being crowded out by the Colonel.
Absolutely.
And soon by Ronald McDonald. And I mean, we just have a, like, all the horsemen of the apocalypse are coming your way.
Like, Nairobi looks nice. I don't know. Like, at the same time, the thing I respect about the fast food industry is standardization of quality of process. So, like, if they're like, all of the potatoes have to be the exact same size. Of course, it's not ideal. But in terms of a business point of view, it maybe puts pressure on local businesses to be like, no, we need to be more consistent in our quality of product and our quality of service, right? That's one thing I'm like, I will respect fast food for that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, how does it affect agriculture as well? Like, the potatoes for KFC come from Egypt. The beef that they use for KFC here, no, not KFC, Burger King, is like pumped up with hormones because they're like, no, we want it to be a certain way. I know they banned that practice in Europe, but they were like, no, Kenyans don't give a shit about that. Like, let's just keep doing this.
Right.
And this is all speculative. I'm not actually saying it happened, but I have read things. I don't have a tin for a hat, though.
I'm ready. I'm very excited about what you're about to say.
I think that they don't care about the things that matter, about people's well-being, basically. They just want to make a buck. And that is essentially what capitalism is, but there's always been a sense of community that we've had here. And I think that that is being lost when it comes to the aid of what food has become now. Whereas I learned how to cook and learned how to eat because every Sunday we either had guests in the house or we went and visited someone who had guests, us as guests, and we would share. It was always about sharing.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's like, it's all about you, right? And that's the thing I don't like about fast food. That's the thing that that's a trend that I'm kind of unhappy about when it comes to Kenyans.
Well, you know what you can smell on that is a bunch of American, you know, I mean, that's a straight up cultural value.
Yeah.
Two people sitting at a table apart from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, you know, we have this like kind of kinfolk moment where we're like, you know, people want to sit at long tables but it's like learning how to walk. Like we just don't have that muscle, really. And you think about food here, like even at the like nightclub last night at Dago's, I guess, where they
Dago's,
they were having like nyama choma or something
outside.
I mean, but they brought it in, and it's just like six people who were there to listen to music, but then also have a big plate of meat. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes and pours water over their hands so they can wash their hands, and then they all just sort of dive in from a single plate. That's how it's done.
Yeah.
You know, like that's how you share food. Like that's how, you know, and on the most basic level, like nothing between you and that experience of sharing food with people.
Yeah.
And it's just something that we don't do well in the States. And, you know, we do it so poorly, we don't even know what we've lost in some way.
And like with the middle class is growing, but we still have like a middle class poor, as it's called, but it's growing. And what that means is people are spending more time working. They're spending more time trying to make more money. We're more aware, we're more informed. and so and more educated, I guess, formally. And so, like, you have Kenyans who are so aspirational about getting the house and the car, and the, and so they'll spend all their time working, the men and the women. And when it comes to food, like, you have to spend, you have to give some time to it.
Right.
You have to plan, and you have to, you know, there needs to be a significant amount of time. It doesn't have to be a lot of time, but just also now the willingness to cook has gone away a lot. And then within the influx of new restaurants, there's new restaurants every month in Nairobi. And that also gentrifies spaces like Dago's, where you find before it was a Nyama Choma place, and now it's some fancy casual dining place, you know, with umbrellas on the ceiling. And it's kind of scary, but it's also like, we've always been a melting pot. It's just, I hope we have the right restaurants come in, and we have the right places for people to commune and to eat right, and to be conscious about where the source of our food comes from, and appreciative of who we are, as opposed to being like, okay, this is KFC, and KFC now here is a premium brand.
Right.
In the States, like, super cheap, like...
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Guys, you will spend like thousands of shillings at KFC. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But I don't know. Like, I just want mentally or culturally for us to be aware of that, and so we don't end up having super fat babies. You know.
Yeah. Attention, America! You're super fat babies.
I do still love you, America.
I mean, listen, it's like, it's one of the things about traveling in the world, particularly in a place like Kenya, that still has this picture. You know, maybe on a global level, they can criticize America, but on a personal level, a lot of people want to move to America.
Yeah.
You know, there's still like this huge aspiration, and it really causes at least me to just look in the mirror and think about these things that are exports, that there's like this cycle and this connective tissue between the desire, you know, the sense that America is where dreams come true, and then they can bring some little piece of America here or experience that on a Wednesday night at a KFC. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at it, and I'm seeing the things that you're seeing, which is like degradation of the family environment, diminished community, very difficult landscape for making good nutritional choices, like a lack of cultural and historical context to what you're putting in your body. I'm just seeing all these kind of, all these little horrors of what, and listen, I'm gonna die in my country. I love America. It's great, you know, get me a MAGA hat, whatever. but it's a weird world that people aspire so deeply for some of these values, which are a little fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, that is your greatest export. It's your culture.
Yeah,
everyone wants to wear, you know, jeans, and we used to sag, of course, in the 90s. Everyone wants to wear the baseball caps and eat KFC, and like that is all you guys. I mean, it's great. I respect how strong you are in terms of what you've done, America as a country. There's a lot of stuff I really don't understand. Guns, and I don't get it. Like, I don't understand why it's a right.
Yeah,
fundamental, right? Like,
that's true. I haven't seen a lot of open carry here. I mean, at the bank here, you will have automatic weapons, but those guys are licensed, presumably. But no, yeah, some aspects of our culture are just truly beyond like import.
But
you know,
I do love how much Americans love their country.
Do you know?
It's very. It can be off-putting. It can be.
Have you seen?
My parents and my siblings lived in the U.S. for a long time. They left when I was 17 to do their master's degrees and their PhDs, and so they did go to get a great education, and they did.
Yeah.
My brother is younger than me by 3 years, and he was a dependent at that age, and so he went and he's basically American. You know, like, he was there for food like 13 years.
Wow.
And my sister's still there. She lives in Washington, D.C.
So you know what you're talking about.
I have a bit of an idea.
These nationalist Americans are also your immediate family members?
Yeah. My sister lived in Philly, L.A., and now D.C.
Wow.
Right? That's, so it's like a nice mix.
That's the gamut.
So like, yeah, but there's certain things about the States food-wise that I like, but... I don't know. I would like more of a community vibe to us, what we're doing.
Well, I mean, and I will say that a lot of the things that I do genuinely love about the States that I don't think you can find in many places are some of these, like, some of the senses that I'm getting from Nairobi too, of just like that melting pot and that influx and that kind of like being a hub for all of these different cultures. I mean, it's not just Nairobi, it's not just the US, but the way of making a virtue out of that and assimilating people and, you know, bringing your parents to get their doctorates, like, you know, we get the smartest motherfuckers, you know, the hardest working, like they're the ones that are coming and making, making the country what it is. And that, you know, that's a value that people can practice. And we obviously have a very spotty record. Like we're trying to pretend that that's not great, right now, but you know, that's something that can be, you know, can be applied anywhere in the world. Just like build a good environment and people will come. And that's kind of what's happened in Nairobi. Like, you know, people from other countries want to come and be here, and make, you know, make it happen for themselves here. So like, that's you know, I'll own that. Like, that's a good value that it's not unique to America, but like, that could be universal.
Yeah. I think we do have an influx of the Chinese here.
Yeah.
Which, as you may know.
You got some Belt and Road things going down.
Absolutely. We are their bitches now.
I mean, the first, I will say this, this kind of, you know, because I hadn't been in Africa at all, I think maybe since 2012. And even then it was just South Africa, and I've been to Egypt earlier, but the Belt and Road thing is only, I'd only ever experienced it from afar, this idea of Chinese influence on the rise in Africa. And I came right out of the airport landing here, and the first fucking billboard is for Kwecho Motai, which is a very expensive, high-end, I forget what it's based on, what the liquor is based on, but you know, I have a bottle at home because like somebody in the People's Liberation Army gave it to me in Nanjing once. And in 7 years, I've only been able to drink about a quarter of it because it is a fucking acquired taste. It's not a soju. Soju is a beautiful gift from the heavens that I would drink morning, noon, and night if I didn't have a job. Kwecho Motai is like, it kind of has got a barnyard kick to it. It's a strong liquor. And it's just got some real funk.
Wait, I've heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
I have heard of it. It's like one of the most interesting alcohols in the world.
Yeah. Like the stuff that's going on in that alcohol is like way beyond what any human needs to get out of their drink. And anyway, I was just, I mean, I know this is something that really only Chinese could value. And they're trying to make inroads in the States, but it's just to come out of the airport in Nairobi and see a giant billboard of like a liquor that only the Chinese could love, obviously advertised for the Chinese who are coming, is a sign of
settlement. Like settlement. They have settled. There are little Chinatowns.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've walked around, you haven't. There's little, we have like little Chinas. One is like a shopping center, but also has, it's a shopping center that has a couple of noodle bars. But then there's another like little food thing that is like a little food district.
Yeah.
And it's all just Chinese food.
And this is what
it's different.
Yeah. This is what April Zhu was saying.
Yeah.
Yesterday was like, you know, she's from the States, like had all the best of the Chinese food and the East Coast and all of that. Mm-hmm. But she was like, you get stuff here that you couldn't ever get in the States. And like, there's like hand pulled noodle guys who were just doing a super legit job. Yeah. So, you know.
And the food guys are all so nice.
Yeah.
They're all so nice. Like, I love them all.
Yeah.
Because I, in fact, like, sometimes I ask, I would like to understand, like, how did you make this? If you make it from scratch, we're used to buying it in a packet and then cooking the noodles or steaming them. But, like, how did you make the noodles? And I could just wait until we're about to close, I'll show you the thing. I'm like, oh, that's fucking great. Like, and they show me, like, how they make the liquids and how they steam them and then how they cut them and how it all works.
Yeah.
And it's funny because like Kenyan restaurants will never show you that. Like if you ever ask like how did you make this, can I come? There's this paranoia that businesses have in this country. Do not take photos of our business. Like don't. Like I've walked into many kitchens. There's a time I went to a Japanese izakaya, which is called Kicheka here. It's one of our better Japanese restaurants here. And I walked in, I asked to see the chef and I talked to him, I gave him feedback. And then like, I was like, can I come see the kitchen? And he said, yeah, sure. And I came in and I saw these knives that I'm like, I'm obsessed with knives.
Oh,
like
nice.
Japanese knives.
All right.
And so I saw, that's the first time I ever held a Santoku. I don't know if you know about
it. Oh,
so
yeah.
It was the first time I held it and I was like, it's much heavier than I expected, but it's also, I was just gushing. I was just like, oh my God, I really want this $800 knife.
Yeah, right.
And I asked him, could I please take a photo of this, right? And he was like, no.
No,
it's like, are you serious? It's just a knife. Like, I'm not going to steal your business. What the fuck?
This is a trade secret.
No, everyone knows about Japanese knives.
Right. Nobody can know that we're using Santoku knives
right?
in a Japanese restaurant.
But like, yeah, they're very, very nice. Oddly.
Yeah. Right. So that's an opportunity, again, of using that superpower, which, again, I've seen, you know, my partner, Matt Goulding, who did it in Japan to great success when he was writing Rice Noodle Fish. And, you know, a country of closed doors will open up to you if you come and ask them about their food. It's like, it's magical, you know, like you can have conversations and reach people you don't even speak the same language, whatever. And you just like, boom, they understand what you understand and vice versa. And it's something I aspire to. It's pretty cool to see it in action, because that's just, it's a great way to move through life, you know, being able to actually communicate with people you wouldn't have otherwise.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's keep that going. That's a good place to leave it. I don't know how fast this book of yours is coming out. I hope it's soon enough that we can tell people about it before I drop dead at my desk.
It's part book, part like, I don't know, proposal. It's like, I want to learn different things. And a lot of big stumbling blocks are access to equipment, access to knowledge, like books, access to...
Pictures of Santokus.
And so I wanted to put this out to say, hey, this is what I'm doing. I'm not like an Instagram chef. I'm not like trying to get famous from it, but I do want to have a legacy. I want to learn as much as I can in terms of technique, in terms of history, and write about it, and then create new things. I want to be
sounds like you need to kickstarter that shit, Indiegogo.
Oh my God, stuff does not work here. But I really want to do that. I want to work with certain chefs. There's a couple of amazing African chefs. There's this guy called Javoy Malonga. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Yeah.
He's from Burundi.
Okay.
And Rwanda, not Burundi.
Okay.
But he is based in Paris.
Yeah.
But he travels around. He comes to the continent and he just travels around with his backpack and his sleeveless shirts and showing off his...
his giant triceps.
Yeah. And he like goes around and talks to like... He does this thing called the School of Grandmas. Where he like talks to like grandmas from different kind of parts of the continent.
Grammars.
Grandmas.
Oh, grandmas. Grandmothers. Oh, wow.
Yes.
And so who's teaching who?
So he learns from them. Like, what is this traditional thing? But he's classically French trained.
Yeah.
And so he takes the thinking of that and makes it more, he refines it and puts like an espuma of something.
Yeah,
like,
the
flowers always come out.
Nice.
And like he makes these beautiful dishes. And I've been talking to him for about almost 2 years now. And I was just like, you know what? I think I want to work with him. So like the book is to send people like him, to send people like Virgilio Martinez, who I hope will see it. And like, I don't know if you know Virgilio Martinez.
I do know Virgilio for sure.
I love him. I love everything he does. Like his thinking is exactly...
Yeah.
I connect to his brain so much because he's all about going outside.
Yeah.
Like he goes outside, he'll look around, he'll be like, what is this? He'll go into weird places. He found these little balls of algae in some pools.
Yeah, that's
some
right.
random, yeah, and like this, nobody thought about it.
Yeah, for context, this is Virgilio Martinez who runs Central in Lima, which to this day I think is probably one of the top five meals I've ever had. I mean, just... ridiculous, very talented young man. All right.
Yeah.
So
I kind of want to do that, but also not him, not these people. I want to figure out who I am, and who I am is many different things, right? And I really, really want to write books. Like that is something I'm very keen on doing. I'm interested in educating people. I'm interested in collecting and processing and distributing information. Like that is my thing.
All right. Well, start doing it.
Yeah.
Get writing.
Yeah.
Send me stuff.
I will send you all the stuff.
I'm a reader, not just a writer, so I'm ready for it. Well, thank you, Joshua. It has been a distinct pleasure chewing a mild stimulant and drinking
a beautiful
Sprite. Yeah. Oh man, I still got hours to go. I'm gonna have to take a little pocket full of this. All right. Thank you, man.
Thanks a lot.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Emily Marinoff was our producer on this episode. Taffy Mokanyadze, our consulting producer. Alexa Van Sickle is our editor. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Shout out again this week to journalist Rajiv Gola, who helped with this episode and then bought me a beer afterwards. Next Monday on The Trip, we continue with our Nairobi series. Kevin Mwachiro knows how to fight for the rights of LGBTQ Kenyans against the blood cancer that nearly overtook him a couple years ago, and yet he is so damn joyous in those battles. Kevin was one of the guests in one of my favorite late Parts Unknown episodes, the one where Bourdain and W. Kamau went to Kenya together, and it was such a pleasure having him on this show. We at Roads and Kingdoms are so looking forward to 2021. Big things are brewing around here. We've got big hopes for being back on the road with you soon. For now, I could not be happier to be with these episodes from Nairobi. Kevin Mwachiro, next on The Trip. We will meet you there.